Hiya, Tim here, and before the podcast, I have a quick note. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from The Stranglers' La Folie. All tracks are written and arranged by The Stranglers, Hugh Cornwell, Jean-Jacques Burnel, Dave Greenfield, and Jet Black. Ain't Nothing to It. It's also credited to Milton Mez Mesro. It was released on 9th of November 1981 on Liberty. Enjoy.
Where real music matters.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
Hi, it's Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. I'm Tim Burgess and welcome to another episode of this show in which I sit down with a band going through a classic album and hearing the stories behind it. So far this series, I've had listening parties with the likes of Garbage, Cast and Joan Armour Trading. To catch up on any of these episodes, just search for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts or on the Rayo app. There you'll find more episodes with artists such as U2, Def Leppard, The Bangles, Sparks and more. Remember, it's not a listening party if you don't get involved on social media. So, message me throughout the show using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party and check out @Tim_Burgess and @AbsoluteRadio for more listening party content. This episode, I'm joined by JJ Burnell from The Stranglers to talk about their album La Folie, their sixth album that was released in 1981. Over their career, they have refused to be defined by category or genre. They've strayed from punk with an initially aggressive ethos to expanding into new wave and art rock as their output became more sophisticated but always remained interesting. JJ, great to see you.
Hi, how
legend.
Are you?
Have you just come in from France?
Yeah. Just flew in to spend a day with the Stranglers.
Yeah, good.
Updating some technology.
Yeah.
Ready for the onslaught later this year and just have to spend some time with you here.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We're here to talk about La Folie. One of my favourite records. It's a listening party, so we go through everything track by track.
Right.
But it's good maybe to get a little bit of sort of background leading up to the record, and before this record was The Gospel According to the Men in Black, which is like one of my, it's like the most curious records for me of all Stranglers, and before that Raven, which is probably my favourite. So it was a great period for the band, certainly as far as I'm concerned. How was it for you?
Well, we perversely never wanted to repeat. Once we had our success, I was always pressured by the record company to repeat it.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you've been an unsuccessful artist for years and suddenly you have a bit of success, very often the temptation is to repeat that.
Yeah.
Go the same way. So you've got a formula and you'll stick to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we always thought that was weird.
Yeah.
We didn't like that idea.
Yeah.
We didn't know how far we could go, you know, musically and technically, so we were trying to go off in completely different directions each record, or each time we got together to write and record, we tried going off in a different way.
Yeah.
And also it coincided with the arrival of a complete new technology, you know, with digital stuff.
Yeah.
So we used what there was around and created a few things which weren't around yet. So we used, you know, you had the Sony Walkman, and there was a little condenser mic in there.
Uh-huh.
And if you put a couple of those above a drum kit, you had this very electronic-type sound coming through. So, and things like that. And then trying to get perfect beats from a live drummer. So you'd try and find four bars of the bass drum going right.
Yeah.
And then multiply that, everyone holding a pencil in the studio, replicating that for however many minutes you wanted to put it onto the 24 track.
Yeah.
So, you know,
so experimental.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Men in Black album was a reflection of that attempt to make sort of semi-electronic stuff with analog instruments, and also trying different rhythms, because, you know, you find a different rhythm that will dictate the song to a certain extent.
And conceptually, you kind of like built from the track.
Yeah.
that was on Raven, the yeah. track Men in Black.
Yeah, because we were obsessed, you know, we were a very close-knit group.
Yeah.
And one person would write or read a book about something and yeah. pass it on to the others.
Yeah.
So we'd all share the same information.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all obsessed with the UFOs yeah. and stuff. And, you know, sometimes Hugh and Jet would go up to Glastonbury tour and try to see if it could see flying saucers. And,
yeah.
and plus the fact that we were, you know, we were indulging in mind control things.
Yeah. And were you in France when you recorded that record?
No. La Folie, we were in France, so we wanted to go completely different from Men in Black.
Yeah.
And we did La Folie. Yeah. Now, the record company were getting fed up with us, and it was no longer United Artists who had given us free rein.
Mm-hmm.
And it was taken over by what we called Every Mistake Imaginable.
Okay.
I think it stands for EMI.
Was that Liberty as well? Was Liberty?
Yeah, they did the Liberty label on the EMI.
On EMI, yeah.
And so we went completely different from Men in Black. We wanted to do our form of pop music. And one of the tracks on it was called Golden Brown, which the record, we thought it was fantastic. It's completely different.
Yeah.
And it's still another time signature, 13, yeah. 14. And of course, the record company didn't rate it at all. They said, well, it's not punk, you can't dance to it, and it's got harpsichord on it.
Yeah.
Real harpsichord.
Yeah, yeah.
But we insisted, and so they released it, thinking, well, we'll release it just before Christmas, so it'll just drown in the tsunami of releases, which happened every Christmas. But it developed its own legs and became a worldwide hit. So then after that, they asked us if we would do the same.
Basically. do another one with harpsichord.
Yeah. So we gave them a song called La Folie, which is a 6-minute song in French, which was about a cannibal, basically.
Yeah. Great single, though.
Well, EMI didn't think so.
I think that's the song in many ways. I mean, I didn't really know that. Because you were singing it and you sang it in French, and just made me think that it didn't really matter about the content in a way. And but I guess it's a good way to play tricks on the label.
Yeah, I think it was. I think we had just two tricks left up our sleeve before they got rid of us. Basically.
Right,
they dumped us.
Right,
and we were quite happy with that. So we gave them La Folie, and then we gave them finally a single, which was never on an album, but which they turned down when it was a demo a few years back, called Strange Little Girl. So
which,
it was kind of revenge on our...
The demo, the 1975 demo, that's on YouTube, it's just incredible, you know? I mean, obviously it's the same song and it's not that different, but there's just something about it, kind of like, that is always in a demo, you know? Everyone wants to try and recreate.
It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it's difficult, but it's just so kind of casual and just beautiful. But that was a good thing to give them, I think. I mean, it seemed like it did in some ways relate to Golden Brown and was probably a huge smash as well. It was a huge smash, wasn't it?
Yeah, massive worldwide. Yeah, but La Folie, the track itself, was a disco hit. At the end of the night,
I've got it as a single. It's like, and it's got Waltz in Black on the B side, and it's just like, it's just a classic artifact for me. If you're a Stranglers fan, you know what I mean, it's great. You know, Curfew, nice and sleazy, Know My Heroes, but then later, you know, La Folie and Thrown Away, and you know, just European Female, just classics. Yeah,
so thank you.
It's a beautiful period, I think. For me,
it was a very creative period for us. I mean,
yeah,
we were just, we were kids in a candy store, you know.
Yeah,
I got this all the recording equipment, and you got this. We had accumulated so much material, and we were just, we had creative diarrhea.
Right, JJ, it's time to kick off this listening party with a song. Let's play track one from La Folie. It's Non-Stop.
She gives up her old life, and she'll never be your wife, 'cause she's got the best lover better than any other.
Stranglers with the first track from La Folie. It was called Nonstop.
Every album leading up to La Folie could be, you know, a listening party. But I think we should start with the first track. So I read notes that it was recorded at the Manor, but yeah. Okay, and that's yeah. Oxford, right?
Yeah, Oxfordshire. Yeah. I think it was a Virgin or Branson property at first. Yeah,
So Steve Churchyard was the producer, and it was mixed by Tony Visconti.
Yeah.
First track's called Nonstop, but also known as Nonstop Nun.
Yeah. Just, it's just,
I mean, how did you lose the nun?
It rhymes, doesn't it?
Yeah. She gives up her own life. She'll never be your wife. She's got the best lover.
Our saviour. Her saviour.
What are your memories of that song?
None whatsoever.
At all. Right.
No, the only thing I remember, the only thing I do remember, well, yeah.
No, it's, I get it.
Yeah. The only thing I do remember was coming out with the two-string part on the bass, which I discovered. I thought, you can put two strings together on a bass, you know, and play them as almost like a chord, but not quite. And so I was just playing about with combinations, finger combinations, and that gave an idea to the rest of the band to make it into a song.
Yeah. And is that how the process kind of went, really? Someone had come up with an initial start of an idea and everyone would join in, or...?
Yeah, it was always, apart from Golden Brown, which was an epic prog rock piece until we stripped it down, chucked lots of it out, and that was from Dave. But all the rest stuff was Hugh and myself staying up late at night, you know, playing things to each other, coming out with little bits and pieces. It was really, we were bouncing off each other all the time for the first 3 years.
So it's generally kind of like, you know, guitars out,
bass out, if we were lucky have a drum machine there, and then work stuff out, and then offer it up to the rest of the others when we thought we had a skeleton of an idea.
Yeah. And pretty much you, Dave, and Hugh sang on most albums, but I didn't notice that Dave sang on this one.
I don't think he does sing on this one, but I mean, even if the initial ideas were mine or Jet's or Hugh's we would always sign it off as the band because I think that makes everyone more better invested in the whole project.
I completely agree.
And it avoids the pitfalls, which is pathetic for musicians to fall out over money.
Yeah.
You know, because I've seen it happen a lot of times. You know, you've got one guy who's more prolific, more productive, creative, and his band, and he ends up starting to have more interest from the media and also more money, right? Yeah. So suddenly it changes the dynamic between people who were previously friends.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what you're in a band for.
Yeah. Initially, you just want to make music amongst mates. So,
I think Nonstop's a great opener to this album, so it like really sets the scene. You know, it's a recognisable sound, but it has a new sheen, I think. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it was a complete contrast to the previous record.
Yeah,
I think we brought those two albums out in the same year.
Right.
So we just had to banish the downer that everyone had on us because of Men in Black album. So we looked for sunlit uplands.
I mean, I would love to do a listening party on the Men in Black album. Let's hear another track. The second from La Folie. Everybody Loves You When You're Dead.
Doesn't matter what you try to hide. The sun comes out and then the truth is red. Your fans will love you.
to Everybody Loves You When You're Dead. Do you have any recollections of that?
Yeah, it was, I think it was written around the same time that John Lennon was shot.
Oh, right, okay.
And we were talking about, amongst ourselves, about how we were getting bad, really bad reviews and bad criticism at the time for various things. And we thought, yeah, but one of us has to die, then they'll love us again.
Yeah.
So we pulled straws to see who was going to.
Did he tour Men in Black?
Yeah, we did. And people were walking out because they couldn't, you know, it was...
Oh, my goodness.
A bit too testing.
Were any of these songs, performed before you recorded them? La Folie?
No. Previously, I mean, the first two albums were, we'd been playing on the road for a couple of years, you know.
Ratus and No More Heroes, yeah.
But by the time we got to Black and White, everything was starting to be not road tested so much.
Yes, more studio.
Yeah,
straight
which,
in.
Which is kind of part of the problem, I suppose, with a lot of musicians. So after that experience, we tried introducing new tracks, unrecorded tracks, into the set just to run them in a bit.
Yeah.
But I think slowly it became more and more difficult to do that.
Yeah.
At the time, anyway.
Do you think that's because, like, you have to keep your new songs a secret or something, or is it...
Well, there was that that time, but, I mean, nowadays, anything that's new is on YouTube before you've even put in a shop or downloaded it, you know. But the technology was different. I mean, you'd have people in the audience. You'd see them in front of you. They got... an 8-track recording tape on their back, and they've got two microphones, so they're just recording the gig.
I mean, Alex Stasko records everything I do. So he's got two mics at the front of the stage.
Yeah, that's good. Live?
Live, yeah, but, you know, before stuff comes out, and I acknowledge him, and he knows that I know, and he knows that I'm fine with it, and I know that he does a good job.
Okay, yeah.
He's been doing it since the 80s, for sure.
But I think now you can't be too precious about it. I mean, if you are going to get upset about people recording, because everyone can record,
I think it's great.
So why be precious about it? Well, don't play it then.
Yeah, no, you know? I mean, I used to love, like, getting, you know, going down to Camden Market and getting cassettes of... you know, there'd be new songs by my favourite band, new song that, there's about to come out in a few months,
And you've already got the album on cassette,
Let's play track 3 from La Folie. This is The Stranglers with Tramp.
Does it matter in the snow? Taking his time, just like you, just like me.
That was Tramp, the third song from La Folie by The Stranglers. JJ.
I've got written here, huge drum sound, thinking it's maybe a Tony Visconti edition.
Yeah, we didn't record with Tony. We got him in
to mix. So maybe like...
So he didn't have any input in the recording.
Any kind of like effects on the drums or anything like that? Maybe?
You know, you're asking someone 40-odd years after the event...
You don't remember him adding something on the drum?
No, I don't. I'm sure he did.
Yeah, I think it kind of like definitely adds to kind of pop production, you know. Maybe, I don't know whether that was something that you were looking for. And then just as you're kind of like getting quite into the idea of it being a pop production, then there's a small, tasty kind of like keyboard solo that you'd hope in some ways would go on longer, but maybe it was, you know, there's a pop element that you were looking for.
Yeah,
which was the opposite of the album before.
Yeah, I think so. I think we'd spent too much time in darkness and in dark thoughts and dark that we thought we need to lighten it
light,
up.
Have something light.
Also, well, make it more accessible to people because...
To bring people in a way, but it's a really healthy sound, I think.
Well, thanks. I think what's the healthy thing is just to not go over previous stuff, you know, to replicate things, you know, because it's not going to last long, is it?
It's good to keep searching.
I think so. You owe it to yourself.
My favourite song by The Stranglers right now, and the track that I would always put at the beginning of a playlist, is Let Me Introduce You to the Family.
All right.
And it was a single.
Yeah.
Was it the first single from the album?
It might well have been, yeah. I thought you could dance to it. No one else could.
it's a brilliant song, this one.
Well, we were thinking of reviving that this year, actually.
I just think it's incredible, and I would love it if you did.
I'll bear that in mind.
Taking some notes. That's fantastic. And, you know, everything about it, it's like the intro, like, you know, with the rundown on the bass, and then what is the sound that comes in after that, after the rundown is complete? Is it a combination of guitar and keyboard, or is it just keyboard? Yeah.
It's, if I recall, it's Hugh on quite a few tracks.
Yeah.
And put just down onto stereo, so it thickens the sound up.
Yeah.
And it's Dave.
Yeah. Amazing. Can you tell me a bit about Dave?
The man himself. He was completely out of this world.
Yeah.
I mean, we used to call him the planet.
Yeah.
Nowadays, he'd be diagnosed as very high-functioning Asperger's, autistic, but at the time we just thought he was odd. And he didn't have the filters, so if you could ask him one question, an hour later your eyes might be glazing over. Because he didn't have the filters that normal people, have. And for instance, before sequences, we had a track on The Raven called Genetics.
I love that song. I love that album. It's just incredible.
Well, he learnt the parts, every single note, over 2 days until it was stuck in his brain. Mm-hmm. So he did. People often ask me, you know, what sequences were you using then? There must be an early ones. I said, Dave.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Part of the condition, you know.
Yeah.
If you can call it a condition, it's just a special talent.
Yeah, completely. I mean, just seeing him on, you know, there's like Top of the Pops and stuff with his, you know, just surrounded by... I mean, it's such an inspiration to our band, you know. I mean, to Rob Collins, our original keyboard player.
Yeah.
He was a Dave Greenfield fan, yeah. He was surrounded by Hammond, you know, and Whirly, and then, you know, maybe Clavinet, maybe. And then, you know, if we were feeling cocky, you know, we'd take a Mellotron out with him as well. You know.
We never went that far, Mellotron, yeah.
But,
I'd love to use the Mellotron.
But he looked so cool in his boiler suit, shades.
He was oblivious to all that.
Yeah.
He just didn't. He never looked in the mirror and said, Dave, you've got foot long nasal hair sticking out there, mate. Can I pull it out?
JJ, let's hear the next song from La Folie. Let me introduce you to the family. Me introduce you to the family. Next up is Ain't Nothing to It. Can you tell me about it?
I think it's based on a book by an American jazz guy called Mesro.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those books that we shared around each other.
Yeah.
And I think it might be called Really the Blues or something by mm-hmm. Mes Mesro. And he was an early jazzer. I think he was Jewish mm-hmm. in America. And it was just explaining about that time in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the chapters was called Ain't Nothing to It. So he, it just was, yeah, kind of an inspiration
yeah.
to write the song.
Fantastic.
And here's that song, Ain't Nothing to It, on Tim's Listening Party. Hold it down and I'll come up with one too, like I said. Ain't nothing to it, just here. Ain't nothing to it, just here. Ain't nothing to it, just here. Ain't Nothing to It from the Stranglers' sixth album, La Folie. Closing side one is The Man They Love to Hate.
All right. I kind of like that.
It's a good one, right?
Yeah, I like the song. I also like the way the vocals were treated.
Yeah.
You take out all the top and take out all the bottom and everything's sort of midi-ish, sort of almost like you're hearing something on a radio.
It's a brilliant pop song. Again, like very kind of like focused and, yeah. If you don't mind me saying.
No, keep it keep going.
You know, you're singing this one. How did you, I mean, you know, would it be fair to say that, you know, it was, you know, Hugh did most of the lead vocals originally?
At the time, yeah, he was.
It's very shared, you know. I mean, you know, there's always, you know, a few by yourself and then one by Dave. And,
well, Hugh had the best voice, I thought. He wrote at that time. He was very prolific with the lyrics. So,
yeah.
He wrote most of the lyrics on that album.
Yeah,
and sang them.
Right. Okay. So if the lyrics were written by Huey, would sing them.
Yeah,
generally.
But not always, because much earlier on, like songs like "Hanging Around," I wrote most of the lyrics on that.
Okay. Yeah.
And the chord sequences. So.
Yeah.
He still sang it.
Yeah.
I deferred to Hugh quite a lot
those
days.
Right.
But as time went by, he was trying to croon more and more, and it was against the... It didn't pursue the ethos of the band. We thought it was a bit, so we had to temper that, calm him down.
So you'd come in and say, I'm singing this one, and, you know...
Not quite. But yeah, he was. I think his greatest strength was writing lyrics.
Yeah, wow, that's great.
And my great strength was writing songs and melodies.
Yeah, fantastic.
Let's press play on The Man They Love to Hate by The Stranglers. Hush words, then hush. The girl she wanted to leave because she loved the man too much.
So, leading up to the making of La Folie, how were you feeling? How are the band? You know, what was the new direction?
Well, just before La Folie was Men in Black, mm-hmm. and that had been really badly received. I mean, it just about made the top 10, but
yeah.
It was everyone thought we were just off our heads, which we were.
Yeah,
but creatively, no one got it. Men in Black. Not many, but a few people did. And it's. I mean, technically, it was quite ahead of its time. And,
yeah.
And we had all these toys in the studio, you know. If you've got... You know, there was a band at the time called I've Got a Fuzz Box and I'm Going to Use It.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so we had studios and engineers who were just do whatever we told them to do, you know, and the experiment and stuff. No idea of what was commercial or not.
No, no, but that's, I guess that's what happens when, you know, the four of you are constantly just together in the studio and stuff like that. I mean, I've been in similar situations where, you know, we've gone on the search for aliens and, you know, and spent, you know, it's just like, well, we're only in the studio for 6 months this time. Next time, let's do it for 9 months. And we did. It was just great times. I mean, I'm obsessed with Men in Black. You know, I think it's a brilliant album. Two Sunspots, fantastic. Man and Machine, you know, yeah. Thrown Away, Just Like Nothing on Earth. Yeah, great songs. But I think probably might have thrown people at the time. You know, but
well, I think it was
after Duchess and stuff like that.
Yeah, maybe, exactly. You know, yeah. It was suddenly from doing pop songs or having the odd pop hit. And there was this, I don't know what you'd call it. It wasn't prog. It was, I don't know what it was.
It's kind of everything.
Yeah. But you know, when you're an artist, as long as you're not chasing the buck necessarily,
and
you're trying to be a bit honest to yourself and trying to see the limits of your talent, then I think that's a healthy thing. You know? It's when you start seeking the success. Then that's the tail wagging the dog, and it's got to be the dog wagging the tail.
Yeah. What were you? How did you take the kind of like the pin-up status and the best bass player in the world?
I took full advantage of it. Thank you very much.
Good. I used to love it. Sort of like reading, you know, that you're martial arts kind of like black belt.
Yeah.
Amazing bass player. And do you think your stage presence came from the martial art?
Yeah, I suppose.
Dedication. No, I don't know. I'm just
a bit of
curious.
Confidence, but also, I mean, our education was nearing the end of the pub rock scene.
Yeah.
So you learn how to front a band in the pubs.
Yes.
Especially when people aren't listening to you or booing you or throwing cans of beer at you.
That was before. Blast wasn't allowed in venues as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, you learn, that's your education, you know. An awful lot of bands managed to get onto your ambition was to get onto the pub circuit.
Right.
From your youth, you know, from graduating from youth clubs and everything, and town halls, you know, well, little village halls, rather.
Let's hear the first track from side two of La Folie. This song's called Pin Up. Side two.
Yes, sir.
Pin Up. Was that based on, you know, your, you know, pin up status at the time?
it might have been. Hugh wrote those lyrics, so maybe it was aimed at me.
Were you getting on then?
Or? Yeah, we were still getting on really famously. Yeah.
Yeah, oh, that's good. Do you remember anything else about it?
Only that with the success, we had we had much more pretension than previously, and so I think Hugh felt that he could chat up models and get away with it.
Were you not standing behind him, sort of like reminding him of...
No, I had my own scene, thank you very much. But I was into girls who liked me more for myself.
I see. That leads us into the next song, which is kind of, you know, very fitting. It Only Takes Two to Tango.
Yeah.
Great song.
It's, well, at the time we were living a renewed version of the Cold War. And I think Brezhnev and, was it Carter? So, President Brezhnev of Russia. And there was, it was an anti-war song, basically.
Right. Yeah. Very psychedelic.
Well, we were quite a psychedelic band.
Yeah. I mean, flanged keyboards and, you know, very worked out and processed vocals, I think. I mean, so was that you and Hugh doing all the vocals on that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's, there's nothing really like that before.
No, harmonies, ascending harmonies. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And layering a lot of the vocals.
Yeah, layering stuff. I mean, so that, I mean, obviously it's an exciting thing to do in the studio, that kind of thing.
It is when you hear the results.
Yeah,
if you've done
yeah.
it properly, it's yeah. it just enriches the whole thing,
yeah.
the whole soundscape.
Yeah. Well, it's a great and kind of repetitive bass and guitar doing the same riff at the end. It's you know, it's quite a song that. Is that going to be in the live canon?
Yeah, we did play it a few times, yeah. And it was a bit more of a challenge for Jet, because he's not doing just normal rock drama. He's doing sort of toms and everything.
Yeah. Time for that song we've been talking about. Here's the eighth song from La Folie, It Only Takes Two to Tango. It Only Takes Two to Tango by The Stranglers on Absolute Radio. Up next is a big song. Golden Brown.
Yeah.
Next song.
Yeah. Yeah, a good way to stick your fingers up for the record company. But it was about...
It's not 7-8, is it?
No, it's
not
a waltz. 13-4. Well, the first three bars are waltz time.
Yeah.
3-4, but then you add another 4.
Yeah.
I've actually seen people try to dance to that. It's really difficult.
Yeah.
You've got that last bar, the fourth bar, which throws you, trips you up.
I mean, can you waltz to it?
Well, you can if you stop on the fourth bar.
And then, so, I mean, you know, I'm in a band and, you know, we've had songs in 7-8.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of quite hard to write lyrics to, you know, until you get the feel of it and... You know, it's hard to get the feel.
Well, it's different. It's outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah, yeah, and you have to get used to it before you can start feeling comfortable in it, and then you know, and then to write a song in that.
Definitely.
So,
I mean,
was it going
all
around a while before everyone settled on it? Or
no, if I recall, we were at my house near Cambridge. On the Fens there, and Hugh and I got a bit fed up with Jet and Dave just always just taking our songs, and we said, right, we're going to the pub, you guys work out, come up with a song, we'll be back in a couple of hours. So we came back in a couple of hours, and it was this really complicated arrangement with that rhythm, with that 13-4 rhythm in it, but it was a prog epic.
Yeah.
And we had to cut loads of stuff out, edit stuff out, and then we had the basis for Golden Brown, and which was about, we were reading, sharing a book about the way the Persians or the Iranians were exporting heroin to the West, to undermine the West, which is a long-term plan, a few... a few unfriendly states have to corrupt the West, which they seem to be succeeding in. So, a lot of the heroin was coming from those parts of the world. Afghanistan and Persia and Iran.
Mm-hmm. And then, so how long did it take to get comfortable with the timing?
Not too long.
Yeah?
Not too long.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, such a catchy, well, you know, the Golden Brown bit.
Yeah. Also the sound, having a real harpsichord, we had to bring in a real harpsichord.
I love a real harpsichord.
Yeah.
In the back of the van.
Really?
Well, we've used one.
Take you a week to tune them up.
We've used one at Rockfield, and it was my friend Thipal Sandra had one, and he brought it. It's heavy and you have to tune it up.
Yeah, that's the problem if you travel.
But it's better, I think. I mean, obviously, you know, better than a sample, even now. You know, with the stuff being so advanced, but you know, it's the real thing. It's nothing like the real thing.
Well, to record it, but to tour with it, forget it.
Oh, to tour with it, yeah, you know, he couldn't do that, no. But just, I mean, shifting it from one studio to the next is like, it's an ordeal.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, did Dave buy one just for the song, or
no? We brought it in. We rented it.
Yeah.
For the song.
Yeah.
Felt it was just the right thing to do.
It's like Baroque.
Yeah. I like all that.
Yeah. Love it.
Let's hear it. The classic Golden Brown.
Golden Brown, fine temptress, through the ages she's heading west. From far away, stays for a day, never a frown with Golden Brown.
That was the Stranglers with the classic Golden Brown.
What about like running orders and stuff like that? How did you work out what's on side one and what's on side two? And
difficult,
know,
isn't it?
Yeah,
unless you make a distinction.
It's an art form, though. Yeah. I think.
Well, doing albums was at one point. Yeah. Not so much now.
Yeah.
Because people don't chase up albums so much. But I think in most musicians' minds, album is a collection of works.
Yeah.
But now you just take out one single. So I think it's a reflection more on people have shorter attention spans these days, and also with an album, you know, you could take people on a 40-minute journey.
Yeah.
So you'd roll your joint on the album sleeve.
Yeah.
Light it up and sit back and listen to it and be taken on a journey.
Yeah.
That's how we looked at it anyway at the time. And of course, the record companies would choose what they thought would be a commercial single from those albums. But the whole thing was different now.
Because I mean, a lot of people think that, you know, that the album sleeve is an object, you know, part of the object, and you know, the source of information for the record.
Yeah.
But actually, it's just a good, you know, a good thing to roll a joint on.
Yeah. But most people, I think, of that generation, our generation, would read, I mean, if you were at all geeky, you'd read all the credits on the album. What studios, what instruments were used, who the producer was, or who you know, what kind of console was recording.
I think it's a brilliant source of information, and I mean, there was certain labels that I really liked that you know, when I was a aspiring musician myself, that I would want to be on, you know, because of, you know, just like because it, yeah, you know, United Artists had you and the Buzzcocks, and
yeah.
You know, and or you know, sort of like Beggars had the Cult and Bauhaus, and you know, it's just like, or the Fall or whatever. Yeah. It's just like, you know, it's like you would. You'd want them to hear yourself.
Well, some labels developed an identity.
Yeah, exactly.
Which certain artists would try to gravitate towards, you know.
Yeah. As a gang, as a band, I mean, you know, I mean, did you move to London from France, or what
no,
happened at the beginning?
I was born from two French parents, both from Normandy.
Yeah.
And after D-Day, my dad, who'd grown up in London, but spent the war in France, dragged Mum off to London.
Oh.
And the French embassy is in Kensington and Chelsea.
Yeah.
And then the poorer part of that borough is Notting Hill. So that's where I was born. Well, St. Mary Abbott's Hospital, to be precise, which is where Jimi Hendrix was declared dead. So that no relationship, unfortunately. And so that's, we grew up there, and then my parents moved to Middlesex, Northwood Hills. We were there for a few years, and then they got the chance to buy their own restaurant in Surrey.
So
then I spent next formative years, I'd say, in Surrey.
Wow.
You know, that the hotbed of blues in the UK, you know. Yeah. Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, all these guys were from Surrey. You know, after a hard day's work in the cotton fields of the city.
Yeah, yeah.
You go home and play your blues.
Wow, and is that where you met the lads?
I met them in Guildford, yeah. And where I lived was just south of there, a place called Godalming.
Wow.
I mean, it's all quite, yeah, posh these days, you know. Surrey is, you know. It's quite ironic that most of the British blues boom was conducted by people from Surrey.
Is that Lou Lewis? Was he there as
no,
well?
No, Lou Lewis was from Essex.
Essex?
Yeah, Southend. Yeah, he had an interesting time with him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Convergent.
JJ, the next track is How to Find True Love and Happiness in the Present Day. Can you tell me about that, please?
Part of the concept of the album was that, it was Jet's concept mainly, was that there's no real thing as love.
Right.
And everything is determined by self-interest,
mm-hmm.
which I would kind of disagree with, mm-hmm. you know, 'cause I think when you've met someone
yeah.
with whom everything is just in harmony,
yeah.
then surely that's what love is.
Yeah, yeah.
That you would put yourself in front of a bullet for them. But Jet
was
very,
very lucky to find that. You know?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, it's extremely rare.
Yeah, it is rare. Yeah.
But when you find it, then you know it. You know?
Yeah, agreed.
But there's obviously this obsession with finding it.
Well, yeah.
Everyone needs to find love, you know, which is, I think, is it's self-defeating, to be honest. And Jet can sit down. At the time, there was Mother Teresa
mm-hmm.
in India, and he was being very cynical about her goodness and kindness and saintliness,
right.
saying, no, she's just doing it to please herself.
Right.
Yeah, I think that was the idea. In fact, I think there's a heart on the album, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A picture of a real heart and not, you know, not the...
No, yeah, that's on one side of the inner sleeve, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and that was just part of... we were trying to be cynical about love.
Right.
Because everyone writes love songs.
It has a very, like, Hallmark sort of birthday card, or Valentine's card sort of element to the inner sleeve.
So we decided we'd put a proper heart on it, as opposed to...
Yeah, the
thing. And
the
we
emoji.
Did the same, around about the same time, with a Christmas single.
Oh.
We wanted to...
Yeah, which was Golden Brown, right?
I don't know if it was originally. No, there's another song. But... I know the artwork was just dead turkeys upside down.
That was a Don't Bring Harry.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And
which
what else was on that? It was an EP, wasn't it?
Yeah. Man in White.
I'm not sure. It was definitely Don't Bring Harry.
Yeah. And, you know, everyone's always have these images of Christmas, nice images.
Yeah.
So we just had hung some dead turkeys.
With the band Vegetarians?
No, not at all. We loved turkeys. Not big fans of turkey. But... yeah.
Well, let's play the penultimate track on La Folie. It's How to Find True Love and Happiness in the Present Day.
Happiness in the present day. Tell him how to find true love. Present day. Then I knew a girl in love with living. Didn't like to stay in one place long.
The last track and title track of the album, which I think is interesting. It's an amazing track. It's a brilliant and brave choice of a single, and the video is incredible. I think watching the video, just like, it's to me, it's like I get the same feeling as Waiting on a Friend by Rolling Stones,
right.
Like Mick and Keith, you know, sort of like meeting up. And I think, you know, just the way that Hugh reacts to what you're saying is kind of like, you know, it does, you know, there's no you know, expressions that, you know, sort of, you know, kind of...
We recorded it in Paris.
It's Montmartre, right?
Montmartre, yeah. around Sacré-Cœur and everything. And all those steps.
Yes, just amazing.
But to get the right vibe... Uh-huh.
And now knowing the context as well, is that what, what you're saying to me? Like,
to get the right vibe.
Expression, no wonder it's expression, that's all.
We imbibed and then filmed all night long.
Yeah.
Until the early hours, until daylight. And so we were tired.
Yeah, okay.
And walking along the Seine late at night, just got the vibe right, I think. I think it was filmed by a guy called Lindsay Clennell, I think. Yeah. And he eventually became a Hollywood film director.
Yeah.
Did things like Highlander or something like that.
Well, the atmosphere... you know, the setting, I suppose, you know, with on the steps and the, you know, the church, is it?
Yeah, church, and Sacré-Cœur.
Yeah, Sacré-Cœur.
Sacré-Cœur, yeah. And in a French bar at 3 or 4 in the morning, smoke, you know, everyone's smoking and stuff.
Beautiful. And La Folie means?
Well, there's not a real immediate translation of it exact. It means the madness.
Yeah.
But it's...
Of love, is that?
Well, it can be. It can be an obsession.
Yeah, okay.
La Folie, it's a folly, if you translate it literally, but it has certain connotations in French.
Yeah.
Il a une folie. C'est une folie, ça. Mm-hmm. But, it's just a madness, but not quite.
I love that. Here's the final song from La Folie. It's called La Folie.
Oui, c'est La Folie. Oui, c'est La Folie. C'était une fois un étudiant qui voulait fort, comme en littérature. Sa copine, elle était si douce qu'il pouvait presque.
So I think we've got time to do Strange Little Girl, right?
Well, Strange Little Girl was based on a on a French story, actually, about an 18th century peasant girl. Mm-hmm. Who comes into the city. So the video kind of was obvious, I think. Just some girl comes into a city, it happened to be London, and life changes for her. You know, she gives herself a Mohican haircut, and suddenly she's not a little country girl anymore.
Yeah. And that was on, I guess it was just a single, on the album originally, but I mean, these days, you know.
Yeah, it wasn't on any album. We did that with a few songs.
Yeah. Kind of Beatlesy. And good value for money as well. Yeah, for the fans.
Yeah.
I like to do that.
We're always trying to do double A sides, which doesn't always work.
Straighten out.
Yeah.
Something better change.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? Because no one really knows which is the A side, but.
Well, it came to our rescue once with our first TV appearance.
So was that...
It was Peaches.
Peaches and Gobbledy Go.
They wouldn't accept Peaches because there was an anatomical term in it.
Yes, yes.
So, but the BBC wouldn't accept that.
So Gobbledy Go, they were kind of quite... They were fine with that.
They were fine with that,
Okay. Well, JJ... Absolute pleasure, man.
Pleasure.
Thank you for talking through, you know, just one of the greatest, you know, records in your already great canon.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to know that there are people out there who know the Stranglers more than me.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, the first record I mean, the first
certainly in the first two records I ever owned was Live X Certificate, and my mate had Sex Pistols album, and I had the other one with loads of swearing on it. And I used to drive my mum mad, so
well, that's always
thanks for that.
A bonus, isn't it? That's always a bonus.
But,
pleasure.
Thanks, man.
Pleasure meeting you. Thank you.
Thanks to JJ Burnell for joining me on this episode of My Listening Party to tell me all about La Folie. Let me finish this episode by giving you a handful of listening recommendations to keep your ears busy. I'm going to go with Garbage and the song Stupid Girl from the album Garbage. We've had a listening party with Shirley, and she's now become my best friend, one of my closest friends. She's a hoot. Kraftwerk, Telephone Call from the album Electric Cafe. It's just, you know, everything by Kraftwerk is classic, so I've been tuning into them these beautiful mornings. Sly and the Family Stone, and this is a song called Time for Living. Charlatans covered this song as a collaboration with the Chemical Brothers for the Help album. Mid-90s, lots of bands joined together, joined forces and put out an album in, I think it was 24 hours. Our contribution was a cover version of this, but Sly was the king, and I think you should hear his version. I've been listening to Polystyrene and her album Translucence quite a lot lately, and I'm going to go with the track Dreaming, which is like number one on her Spotify algorithm. I would normally go way past number one, but it's number one for a reason. It's such a good song. So it's Dreaming by Polystyrene. Don't forget, if you tuned in late and missed any of this evening's show, or you want to replay any previous listening parties, just search and follow Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts, or on the Rayo app. There you'll find a whole archive of listening parties with the likes of New Order, Texas, Simple Minds, Libertines and Tears for Fears. Every song is taken from The Stranglers' La Folie. All tracks are written and arranged by The Stranglers. Hugh Cornwell, John Jack Burnell, Dave Greenfield and Jet Black. Ain't Nothing To It is also credited to Milton, Mezro. The album was released on Liberty in November 1981. See you next time.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.